This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
It's Tuesday. It's still Tuesday. And my next guest, of course, is here, Benedict Phiri, and Managing Director of Loose Presidential Specialist Council. And we'll be talking about Nosiviwe Mapisa Nqakula and what happened in court and the particular judgment that's been made in this particular application to have an arrest, in essence, not followed through. And then also all the other issues of that particular application that were made. And that application was made, I think that urgent application was made, and the fact that it was urgent as well, and the fact that it was made on the 25th of March, and everything that's happened throughout and within that particular space. So much to actually talk about in light of what's happened in that case. I'm not going to bore everybody with the detail of what happened in court. Everybody does understand that that urgent application was, of course, dismissed with costs, and it was also judged as not urgent. And then, of course, the judge making specific references to, you know, what is an illegal unrest, and also whether the case would be weak or not. So, in essence, so let me bring Benedict Phiri back, or not back into the conversation, into the conversation. Benedict, welcome to Power 98.7. Welcome to Power Perspective. How are you, Benedict?
I'm very good. Thank you, Denzel, and thank you for having me, and good evening.
Sure, sure. Benedict, let me just check. Is it Loose Presidential? That's how you pronounce it?
It's pronounced Use Prudentia.
Use Prudentia.
Yes.
Use Prudentia.
That's right.
Got it. So, Benedict, you know what, Benedict, and pronunciation and the way things are written these days, you've got to ask. Use Prudentia it is. Do you have many people doing what I just did and asking, you know, whether it's the right pronunciation or not, Benedict?
Yes. It's not many, but it's a usual query, or, you know, check, because I think the I sometimes looks like an L.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a usual one, but not many.
Got you. I'm one of those few then, obviously. Benedict, let me start with, I'll get into the finer detail, and I have so much to ask about the finer detail in essence as well. But in your broad view, you know, when all of this was taking place, and you heard of the application, firstly, you know, there would have been the news of a raid. There would have been the news of potential charges and you know, to follow. Then there would have been news around a potential arrest now to follow. Then there would have been news around, you know, various political, you know, entities doing what they would have done. Then, of course, there was the application to court that I shouldn't be arrested, and should I be arrested, all sorts of things. And then within that application, too, there were various things that were being asked for and needing. And if they were not asking for them, they were asking the particular judge to have a sneak preview of them so that the judge could be happy. And there were particular statements made about either a weak case and also, you know, the arrest itself will be illegal, and then issues of prominence, and I have a position of standing, and all of it into that particular space. You, as Benedict, what was your broad takeaway as things were unfolding? Were they as unique as they were? Was it, you know, normal legal processes being followed? You know, some instances will say to you, this is absolutely normal, where, you know, you will engage a court about not being arrested, or, you know, and how to hand yourself over, and negotiations with the NPA or the police, and when to hand yourself over, and how you will hand yourself over, in the company of who you will hand yourself over. That I can understand, that, you know, that might be negotiated. So many people have done it over the years, where instead of being arrested, they've handed themselves over. Then you get to the other aspects of, you know, beginning to ask, and judicial and asking also the judge to have a judicial peek and look into the docket, if not then to give it to them so that they understand what's going on in this particular aspect. Was it all just, you know, normal, above the norm for you, or were there aspects that were just different this time around?
When you think of the NPA and how they have a number of means in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, in terms of which they can bring a person who's accused of a crime to court, you know, so they can secure their attendance through either a summons or a warning to appear in court, or in this particular case, an arrest would have been the method that would have been preferred. So, I mean, it's regular that, you know, the NPA would choose one or, one of these methods. And in this instance where somebody is represented by a lawyer, you know, it's not unusual for arrangements to be made for when the processing happens, the lawyer's available and there with their client. I think what became a little bit interesting in this particular case was that while all of this was unfolding, Nosiviwe Mapisa Ngakula wanted a specific lawyer who wasn't available on the days that the NPA had suggested. And, you know, she asserted that as a right that she has to legal representation, which was really stretching it further than is actually the case. You know, I think, yes, everybody is entitled to legal representation, but it's not specifically a particular person. And especially when, you know, in this particular instance, someone else in the firm could have been available, or in fact, any other lawyer could have been available. So, you know, when I started seeing that, it started seeming like there's been then a different accommodation for her to, you know, to sort of assist her, so to speak, with how she gets processed through the system. So that became a little bit concerning because it seemed that there was a regime that would have been applied to her that wouldn't necessarily befall any other person in a similar position. And then I think what became even more intriguing was the fact that this urgent application was brought to effectively stop an arrest, which is really quite extraordinary when you think of what the NPA is meant to do. And, you know, ultimately, the NPA can bring anybody to court who is reasonably suspected of a crime. And to imagine that somebody could say, I'm not sure if this suspicion is reasonable on the grounds that she had, because ultimately she had no grounds. You know, she basically said that it's a single witness. And because it's a single witness, you know, the evidence may not stand up to scrutiny, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not a reason why you would not be reasonably suspected of a crime, you know, or why the NPA could, you know, be acting in bad faith or illegally, effectively, if they were coming to arrest you. So that already was quite extraordinary because those grounds were never going to make it. You know, for something as extraordinary as stopping an arrest. And on top of it all, the matter was brought on an urgent basis. It was a couple of days, effectively, about 3 days, when you count or do the weekend as well. Just a little over 3 days from when the application was lodged and when it was heard, which wasn't justified by what was actually going to happen and what had actually transpired. So, you know, already when that sort of started transpiring and those details started coming out, it, you know, it became clear that what we were dealing with was initially, you know, an accommodation to Nosiviwe Mapisa Ngakula that could have, you know, worked in the ordinary course, but it had gone far and she had actually tried, you know, using the law, which and unfortunately she didn't succeed. To actually give herself a, you know, a more equal standing, as far as I'm concerned, because no one is entitled to not being arrested. You know, it's not, that's quite an extraordinary thing to assert.
Benedict, let me just ask for something that I also thought was an abnormality. Was there any way or did you think of it also as different, the fact that, you know, the legal team was asking for the witness statement and or the case to be, that was going to be made out, to be given to them so that they could, you know, have an understanding whether it was a weak or an unlawful process that was taking place? That particular aspect was also new to me, in the sense of, I think only at a later stage where charges are brought and, you know, all other things are done, that you then have some insight into that. But to have insight into that particular aspect even before you are arrested, and at the beginning of a conversation about how you're still to be arrested, and you needing to have some insight into what that particular docket looks like, that felt for me, you know, a bit, you know, abnormal in essence. But also then, I then was wondering about it when I thought, do people then normally ask judges to have a judicial peek? If they are not given the document per se, then, you know, what, to give the judge, or the judge to have a judicial peek into the docket to find out whether it's weak or unlawful. Just talk to me about that particular aspect, whether that's also pretty much of a norm.
No, that's also not a norm. You know, at this stage of the proceedings, you know, before even a person is arrested, you wouldn't have access to the docket.
That's what, and I understand. You
know, exactly. And as the criminal process unfolds subsequently, once the charges are brought, et cetera, then the access is afforded, and someone is afforded the ability to plead, et cetera, et cetera. But this would not have been the stage of the proceedings where she would have had access to the docket. And secondly, you know, a judicial peek at what the docket says is not how things go about. And I'll make an example of Julius Malema. In his assault case, you know, at the end of the state's case, he brought an application to be discharged because his view was that the evidence that the state had presented was not sufficient to sustain the charges, and he should actually not take the stand on that basis. He obviously didn't succeed, and the trial continued even though he was acquitted of the charges. So, you know, that kind of scenario would be available to Mapisa Ngakula, because, you know, at the end of the state's case, if really it is the case that the single witness, the evidence that they have cannot be corroborated by other, you know, objective evidence, etc., and there is doubt whether Mapisa Ngakula committed the crimes, then she would have been, you know, allowed to bring that application to discharge the matter, and the magistrate would have considered it appropriately accordingly. So, you know, it was quite a brazen attempt to accelerate a few of these processes and bring them up to the front of what typically wouldn't be the manner in which a criminal matter would proceed.
Sure. Then I have to ask you, Benedict, if you know, the layman who are watching, you know, was looking at this, and all the language and processes were unfolding and the various arguments were being made, and legal people like yourselves were going and saying, oh, this is new. Oh, wow. Okay. You know, is it something where if Denzel Taylor is about to arrest it, I could, in essence, repeat what's just happened? I could avoid the arrest, and I could go to court, and then I could do the application, and I could, or you know, what is that process? In essence, was it to delay a further process, and or can it be done? But in essence, I'm asking a question because it was done, but I'm asking why it was done.
Yeah, you know, when you see it now in hindsight, it appears that the reason it was done was really solely to delay, because, you know, there's no other legitimate ends that could be achieved, you know, by the way that Ms. Mapisa Ngakula went about this. So it appears, you know, her lawyer was only going to be available tomorrow anyway. Yeah. That's the date she wanted. And, you know, in the greater scheme of things, he'll probably be back by the time that whatever arrangements are made by her and the NPA for her to be processed, etc. So, in the greater scheme of things, it appears that she achieves what she ultimately wanted to achieve in the sense of her lawyer being available. But I think it was a dangerous matter to bring because it really made her lose credibility. And I think it is good that the court basically said that, you know, to allow a matter like this would open up the floodgates to many people who are in the same position to actually run to a court and to try and stop an arrest when actually that's just not available in the ordinary course. And I think it's important that the court mentioned that strongly, that this kind of relief would not be available to anybody just due to its extraordinary nature. And to have given it would have led to that kind of a scenario where the criminal justice system would effectively, you know, grind to a halt because anybody could then just run to court in an urgent bid to try and stop their arrest. And I mean, that just, you know, would negate the whole purpose of the whole thing.
Then Benedict, let me ask you this question about equality and before the law and equal before the law and right to representation and all of that. A lot of people don't have the representation they want and can't afford the representation they need and they want and all of that. But that's a whole different conversation. And then there's the equality before the law and this whole aspect of accommodating, you know, nosiviwe mapisa ngakula, accommodating her to the extent of, you know, having the conversations and or, you know, going through this ritual that was being played out that we then ultimately have seen being corrected by the judge who then says, you know, I can't say whether it will be illegal, the arrest, and I also can't say if the case will be weak and I'm not going to, you know, have a peek into what the docket, you know, says because that also is just not generally done. But in essence, what Nosiviwe Mapisa Ngakula's legal team was arguing when they were arguing this point was that she is someone of standing and she's someone important and she is, you know, someone who is third ranking in the hierarchy of South Africa and all of this and all of that. And the NPA in its language also used similar terminology of suggesting that because of her ranking and her position and or they were engaging it and they hadn't just arrested and they hadn't done that and they hadn't and hence they were following a particular route that they were following. How when you hear those particular arguments being made about people's position and or ranking and or standing then in society versus mine, who I might not have, and allowances not being made for me, potentially, but somehow accommodation made for her. How does that speak to equality in front of the law when I see that language from both sides, in essence, talking of her standing in society? Whereas, you know, if I read the Constitution, we are all equal, you know, in front of the law, but somehow accommodation seems to be, or accommodation seems to work for some, but not for others.
I think it's disappointing that an argument like that was made as a reason and put forward as a reason, you know, to support her not being arrested effectively. Mm. Although, you know, I have sympathy for that argument because I think it stems from wanting to draw parallels between the president's private prosecution by Mr. Zuma and this particular matter, you know, because in that particular instance, there was an argument made around, you know, he shouldn't be, the president shouldn't be in the dock because he wouldn't be able to attend to his duties as president of the country, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But the reason why that argument was made in that particular matter was because Mr. Zuma didn't follow the administrative tick box that he was meant to follow in bringing that private prosecution. And that was essential to how that private prosecution came to being. And if, you know, you missed a particular box, you didn't pay the security for the costs, or you didn't attend to issuing the summons, and you didn't get that nolle prosequi certificate as it was, then you couldn't get out the starting blocks. This is completely different, you know, because this is not an administrative issue that then impinges on somebody's rights, which was the case with the president. This is a case where the NPA is constitutionally given the ability and the scope to actually bring someone to court who is suspected, reasonably suspected of a crime. So you didn't have any of those administrative technicalities to be exploited and to be drawn parallel. So, you know, it did come from there, but unfortunately it wasn't well made. And it, you know, the value of it was lost because that distinction wasn't particularly clear. And it hits as if it's somebody to be afforded special treatment simply because of her ranking in society. And I think I like the way that the judge dealt with it effectively because, you know, that should not actually even be considered. Yes, she was afforded a courtesy, as the judge had indicated, but it was a courtesy and it did not at any point crystallize into a right in the manner that she had tried to enforce it. So it was unfortunate, I think, that that argument was made because, you know, it really stretched where you could take, you know, the parallels between the president's matter and a normal criminal matter. And, you know, the parallels weren't there to be drawn. And, you know, so it was a bit unfortunate that we had that argument because it makes us think, you know, and question, are we different? You know, and we shouldn't be because, you know, everybody should be treated the same and nobody should be afforded any special treatment simply because of their office or who they are in society.
Benedict, a technical question that I'm just wrapping my head around. Did the urgency aspect fall away because the NPA had said that they were not going to oppose bail, or, you know, had they opposed bail in essence, that might have been then, you know, seen as an urgency, and, you know, there were repercussions that, you know, were going to happen. But because the NPA had said it was not to oppose bail and that normal proceedings would then have sort of followed and things would have developed the way they would have, did that have an impact on the urgency aspect as well? The fact that, you know, they were open and they were not going to oppose bail in any way. So I was wondering whether that had an impact on the urgency application and that's why it was kind of dismissed as well.
Yes, I think that certainly did have an impact on the assessment of the question of whether the test for urgency has been met. Yeah. Because the test for urgency is whether you will have substantive redress in due course. So, you know, if you as a litigant are saying to the court, if I don't get heard today or next week or whenever I set it down for, and I get heard in the ordinary course, by the time the matter gets heard, then basically my rights would have been effectively evaporated. Mm. So in this particular instance, you know, it mattered that the state had made, you know, these gestures to Nosiviwe Mapisa-Nqakula to say, you know, we agree that we won't oppose bail, we'll process you as soon as possible, and, you know, the discomfort or the inconvenience to you will be minimized. I think that matters, that a gesture was made to her. But I don't think it would have been critical of the matter had that not been the case, you know, because in any event, she would have been entitled to be at a court when that bail application gets made or when she gets presented to a court, and she would have the same remedies that she was asking that court to have, right, to the extent that she wanted to insist on that. So her rights, she wouldn't be in a worse off position because the matter is being heard later. And I think that's the point that is about urgency. So, you know, that was never going to be on the cards for her, whether or not these arrangements were made. The point of the matter is that, you know, she was going to be in a similar legal position, whether the matter was heard a week from now or in the ordinary course, and it's nothing that deserved the attention of the court or extra protection for her.
Benedict, what happens now? I mean, from your perspective, and I would assume two scenarios could arise from how things happen, you know, in the way forward. One is that we go back to the beginning where the NPA was talking to the lawyers about Nosiviwe Mapisa-Nqakula handing herself over, and then, you know, the processes start from there. Or, you know, the other could be that they don't do that and they, you know, do arrive at the house and they do a rest. That's just me thinking aloud that those are the two options. But obviously, I think the first option is always the one that you want to proceed with because, you know, the person might not be a flight risk. The person is now, you know, has the illegal representation. All the boxes seem to be ticks. And so, you know, an arrangement now with the legal team is made about, you know, representing yourself at a police station or handing yourself over, and or they could just do the other, which, you know, has prohibited them, this particular application prohibited them in the first place because there needed to be this court process that happened and they could go and arrest. Are those the two options that could materialize now, and which one do you think would be followed through on?
Yeah, I think you've got the options correct. Those are the two sort of courses of event that would be available to the NPA. I think realistically, Nosiviwe Mapisa Ngakula's lawyer, legal representative, would have reached out to the NPA. I think both of them would have anticipated that this could have been a potential outcome of the matter.
Sure.
And I think, you know, if I was her lawyer, I would have written to the NPA and saying, you know, if this is the eventuality that the application gets dismissed or struck off the roll, obviously we'd be back to a situation where it would be favorable and it would assist if there was an orderly process insofar as dealing with her being processed through the system. Mm. So I expect that, you know, whatever is meant to transpire would be by arrangement or reasonable cooperation between the parties. Mm. I think if there's a situation where that cooperation is not forthcoming, then we might see the second option of an arrest. But certainly I would expect that, you know, when she appears at a court, which she will, it will be as a result of some cooperation between the parties.
Then let's talk about that. I was just looking at, you know, that if you showed me the middle finger as maybe they thought she did, then, you know, they would proceed in a particular way to exercise their rights and their responsibilities and affect arrest in that particular way. But I think I'm with you on this one, Benedict, whereby I think the communication and the facilitation of how she presents herself is going to win the day. Let's talk about the process now of the engagement. When I was talking last week to her lawyer, who will now be her lawyer or her legal representative tomorrow, and I was talking to him last week, he went through why all of these reasons why they were doing what they were doing and justifying them in essence and you know, speaking to it. But he spoke about when she appears in the dock and the humiliation of that and the humiliation of an arrest and that for a person of her stature, whatever, would be, you know, the picture of it. Is that at all an issue in a particular case of this particular nature? Does it have any standing in whichever way, you know, things are presented within the court? Does it prejudge? Does it estimate in the view of the, you know, person watching and or listening, a perception of her image already and then a judgment of that particular space already? Does it have such an impact, this whole thing of trying to avoid an arrest and handcuffs and police cell and police station and or, you know, and sitting in the dock? Does it have such a huge impact on the actual outcome of something or a reflection in how people engage the whole storyline?
You know, I think ultimately, you know, what matters really is, you know, whether Mapisa Ngakula will receive a fair trial and whether the judge that is adjudicating or the magistrate that is adjudicating that matter can give effect to a fair trial. Mm. So, you know, how she's seen or perceived by herself, especially in this particular instance, more than anything else, really doesn't impact, you know, and whether we might see her and feel pity for her or, you know, I think maybe a sense of embarrassment, I think that doesn't feature in the assessment overall of whether
Benedict, they made it an item to feature, you know, from her legal team. They spoke to it as though it was, you know, a matter that needed to be dealt with. You couldn't have her sitting in the dock and that is what they made it a feature of. And I found it strange because I've seen Jacob Zuma sit in the dock endlessly and people take pictures of him, you know, in that particular space. And I was wondering, you know, what would be new here of somebody who's accused and having to stand trial of a certain charge?
Yeah, that's why it's an unfortunate feature of the case that, you know, something like that could have been expected to be an important consideration. When it doesn't feature, as you say, we've seen, you know, someone like Jacob Zuma in the dock many times, and we'll see him in the dock again, given, you know, the fact that the matter has, you know, effectively cleared now, you know, to proceed again. You know, it was an extraordinary argument to be made. And, you know, when we saw that, at least in legal circles, you know, it was a bit strange that, you know, an argument like that could be put. But, you know, when you help your client, you do try as many arguments as you can when it's necessary. And I suppose in this case, they thought it was worth the gamble to go with that argument.
Benedict, let me, maybe you can answer it, maybe you can't. The aspect of, and I had to put it to the lawyer, I mean, Mapisa Ngakula is a political animal at the end of the day. Has been her entire life. The position she holds are because she's, you know, a political animal at the end of the day. Someone in the ruling party who has played, you know, a significant role over the years, member of parliament, NEC member, deputy minister, you know, and then minister of home affairs and then minister of defense and then speaker and all of these particular positions. But, you know, a political animal. And I asked the lawyer and I said, you know, to your knowledge, when you do speak to Mapisa, you know, Ngakula about all of this, is there a conversation that you have that says, you know, it might be politically motivated and or it has political strings attached to it and or, you know, There are political backers and you might have fallen out of favor, hence your name has been thrown into the hat and not so many others. From a legal perspective, once the law begins to deal with you, I suppose that particular aspect falls away, even though you might want to make it. But in essence, you know, the charges will be what they are. The process will be what they are. The judge will not take into consideration that. Or does the judge, as in also, you know, Jacob Zuma has also made those particular arguments in front of a judge. Ace Machashula has made those arguments in front of a judge. All other people who stand in front of the judge and who are accused of general corruption stand and say there is a political, you know, element behind this and hence. Does it have any influence on any case, and not particularly this particular case, but does it play a role at all, you know, or is it something that's thrown out at the public for the sake of, you know, sympathy and all other that I am being dealt with in this particular manner because I have fallen out politically, not because I have generally done wrong? To who does that argument, you know, fall to?
Yeah, and you know, and when you play back the examples that you've played of the people that typically raise that argument and how they've raised it, I think in each instance there hasn't been proof of this political, you know, agenda or, you know, that is being orchestrated by, you know, against them, right, through the bringing of these criminal charges. So it would have been a different story if criminal charges are trumped up and they have no basis in law to be brought, and they are simply brought because of a political agenda. That is certainly something you do raise to a court because it plays hand in hand with the fact that the charges will not stick at their end of the day, right? Mm. So that would be something that would quite clearly be said or put to a court when it's time to have a discharge application at the end of the state's case. I think it's, as we've seen, you know, it's a defense that's used to no useful avail other than to confuse us as members of the public, because ultimately when the legal cards stack up, a defense like that doesn't stack up because, you know, ultimately there will be, for instance, a wig that we can point to that money was brought in, or there will be a receipt of someone having withdrawn cash at a particular place to go and take to Nosiviwe Mapisa Ngakula's place. Or there will be GPS logs, you know, of the vehicle she was traveling in. You know, there will be some, you know, objective evidence that will corroborate whatever's put there. And then it will be obvious that a defense like that would never work, right? But if we were in a situation where things were trumped up and there were absolutely no truth to it, and you could see that the NPA or the prosecution was being brought for completely an improper purpose or improper motive, then a defense like that could stack up. But I don't think that's realistic, given at least what we've seen around what she's accused of and how these monies were paid and received. You know, but anyway, we'll see how it progresses. But, you know, it's unfortunate that a defense like that is put and mainly to confuse and less of a legal defense in reality.
Let me ask you, Benedict, before I let you go and rounding up the conversation, the issue of plea bargaining, and this I found interesting because I hadn't seen it before and I haven't read it before, but her lawyer was suggesting to me that in essence what the NPA and the judicial system has done is that they've gone into some form of plea bargain, and he said it numerous times with the witness in this particular case, and that they are looking at the bigger fish here. And he quoted, you know, in essence, what the application was and what the prosecutorial procedure was, and that is hence, you know, the plea bargain. And so the person would then give evidence and you know, suggest all the wrongdoings because there was a bigger fish that could be, you know, had at the end of the day. We've seen it previously in previous you know, times. I think one of the biggest ones was Jackie Celebi, when they went for Jackie Celebi and they left all the other, you know, individuals, you know, aside. There was an individual, I just miss his name now, who was shot on a bridge, Kibble, shot on a bridge. Nobody at the end of the day charged or sent to prison for him, because people began to have plea bargains all over the case, and I don't think anybody went to jail for Brett Kibble at the end of the day, apart from them trying to maneuver the political space of that political story. But the shooters who had come forward themselves and actually said, I then stood at the window, shot Brett Kibble, he died, and I drove off on a motorbike with so-and-so. None of them actually went to jail. So plea bargains do happen. In this particular case, this particular attorney lawyer was saying to me, there is a plea bargain agreement here with the witness, and so they are trying to get to the bigger fish in essence. Do you know whether there is a plea bargain in this particular instance or not? Or, you know, is this a... And I'd say it, would this be a pretty norm in a case like this where, you know, if you can get to Nosiviwe Mapisa Ngakula and you could, you know, leave the person who actually, you know, got the tender and paid the monies and made the bigger profits, leave them off the hook? How do you judge? What makes a case to be judged in that particular way? Or, you know, let's start with whether you know that there's a plea bargain arrangement in this case or not.
The reports are that there is a plea bargain with the state witness, and, you know, they were being investigated, and ultimately they decided that they would testify on behalf of the state. And that's normal. That's utilized in the Criminal Procedure Act in a number of matters. I think one of the latest where, again, it's a single witness, is the VBS matter, where the CFO, Philip Truta, I think his name is effectively the person who turned on everybody else and told the story, right? And the state has offered him that plea bargain. But there's a critical piece that people miss around the plea bargain, and is that the witness has to be very frank with the court, and the court has to assess that the witness is being absolutely truthful for that plea bargain to be available to them. So the court can turn around after listening to the witness and say, well, you know, you've given us somewhat of a story, and it was really for you to exculpate yourself rather than really tell us the truth, and therefore we don't, you know, endorse the plea bargain arrangement, and the court could basically impose its own sentence, you know, basically after that. So, you know, it's still subject to the court's determination whether a witness can utilize and make use of a plea bargain. And that really depends on the quality of that witness's testimony in the greater scheme of the criminal proceeding. So it is a process that is utilized, and it sounds like it's being utilized in this instance. As I said, it doesn't mean that the evidence is not reliable, because the court has an apparatus to test and ensure that that evidence is useful in the context of that plea bargain.
Benedict Phiri, appreciative of your insights. A really, really interesting conversation, and I really, really do appreciate the insights you've given to us tonight on something complex, and also complex in the way it was brought to court, and I think in the way that it's still going to be delivered in court. Thank you so much for just making it simple also for us to have an understanding of some of the complex issues and an understanding of some of the other issues that, of course, that are legal. Benedict, I'm going to say thank you for coming on to Power Perspective tonight. Thank you for coming on to Power Perspective. It is much, much appreciated. And I can pre-warn you, Benedict, that in essence, as we do see this case, you know, proceed and go forward, I'd love to have you back here on a regular basis just to begin to talk to it and give us the kind of insights you've given us tonight to this particular story.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Denzel.
Benedict Phiri, thank you so much. Managing Director at, of course, Youth Prudentia Specialist Counsel, talking to us there.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.